You said you went on several surveys of the country when you were in Iran.
We went out and visited all the installations and the critical areas, both in terms of the forces and the terrain.
How able did you think that the military people you met with were, the Iranian military men, military leaders?
Well, again, as I said, I think it varied. Probably the chief of the Air Force, General Halimi, was I would say he was the outstanding commander. And I really didn't have a chance to assess all of the commanders within that short period, you see. But most of them were not, they just hadn't been educated for and brought up in terms of the modern armed force. And for example, one of the later chiefs, Chief SCS Ariana, but his basic background had been in terms of fighting out in the western part of Iran against the insurgencies with the Kurds and so on. So you had that carryover period. I can answer it a little better when we talk about period 69. I thought they'd made a considerable improvement in terms of the quality of the forces and so on.
Now, after making your survey, what kind of recommendations did you come up with, generally?
Well, generally we came up with some suggested changes in the force structure.
Well, what kind of a force structure did you think was necessary? I'll just turn off for a second.
Okay. That with regard to the defense for the country, the need to take into account and necessity for military security within a broader context. We said here, this is in terms of the memo of the one to the Shah.
This is the report that you drew up. I'm reading here
the memo from the United States to the Shah, which had been declassified. For strength and political unity and internal capacity to resist subversion and the need for continued economic development. So this was the point we tried to make at the very beginning. That the concept for defense must provide for all contingencies, ensuring a balance of capabilities to meet each threat. Recognize the capability of the U.S. and its allies to deter Soviet aggression, and should deterrence fail to defeat it, take into consideration the collective security arrangements in the CENTO Treaty. Concept anticipated Iran's armed forces should be called upon to support other Iranian security forces directly responsible for Iran's internal security. And we talked a little bit here about the need for the forces to participate in civic action programs. With regard to the defense against external threats, based on a forward strategy using the national mountain barriers to the north, to the northern border. The need for having neutral support of ground, sea, and air forces. Again, the concept for ground defense based on a forward strategy using maximum use of terrain to achieve economy of force. So we get into we got into a good deal of discussion here in this about the detailed disposition of forces and so on. The force structure for the forces should take into account not only the concept for defense, but also the capabilities of the forces and the equipment and resources which can be presumed to be available to them. But the most effective Iranian military force which could be supported for the next 5 years is one limited to a total strength of about 160,000 people.
So this involves a reduction in the size of their army, right?
Yeah.
And that was...
Within this total force, there should be an army of 7 infantry divisions of 10,000 personnel, specifically tailored and equipped to approximately... totaling and necessary force-wide logistical support and air support. We made quite an effort here to say that they have to be capable of supporting.
Now, would future U.S. military assistance be conditioned upon the reduction in the size of the Army? Was that a condition for any further military assistance by the U.S.? Was it cost in that way, or was it more...
Then we also proposed an airfield development program, early warning program for the construction of radar stations at Hamadan and Desfil, tying it into the central. Here is the answer to your question. In further on to its intent to assist Iran in providing for its defense, the U.S. is prepared during the next 5 years to provide equipment and other support for Iranian forces as set forth in the attachment and so on. It is understood that the provision of this support will be dependent on A, the transition of the Iranian armed forces over the next 2 or 3 year period to the agreed manpower level, upon demonstrated ability of the Iranian armed forces to absorb and effectively utilize and maintain the equipment, and on the ability of the country to provide housing and support facilities.
Now, you presented this memorandum to the Shah?
I didn't. The ambassador did.
Oh.
This is. I participated in the drafting of it. I went back out to Iran in September.
Oh, you returned?
Yeah, for the purpose of working on this.
Did you discuss these proposals with the Shah at any meetings, or was that less than the ambassador to do that?
That was the ambassador did that, and I'm not sure just how, but it was a very short period, I believe.
Did you discuss these issues with some Iranian military people that you were working with? Talk about these goals.
Not until this was delivered.
Okay.
And then I left immediately afterwards.
Did you get a sense of how the Shah reacted to this memo, or?
Oh, my general impression was that it was acceptable to him.
Okay.
I think that there was concern over this question of this. Terminology of how many, what you construed as a division. And there were some concerns on his part of calling a division a brigade, which would, was what in some instances we would have heard. As long as we stuck to the numbers, that wasn't too critical an issue.
You drafted the memo or yourself?
Another officer and I drafted it.
Who'd you work with? Do you recall?
I have to think of his name. Two others, an Air Force colonel and an Army colonel.
Did your report schedule estimates of military assistance requirements also?
We dealt with types of equipment that was there.
So that was all part of your report?
That's right.
Yeah.
Specific types of equipment. Armored personnel carriers, vehicles, combat support equipment.
So these are all things that will be delivered in the future under the military assistance program?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the important point is that there's the usual caveat that this is subject to availability of funds and so on, but basically in here we talked about the importance of qualitative improvement, particularly in the Army, and the need for procurement and training of long-term personnel. And again, going back to this question about the ability of the country to assume the sophisticated equipment and the amounts of equipment that the Shah had in mind. But that problem is not, you know, was not peculiar to Iran. It's peculiar to any developing country.
Did you follow up on the report's implementation? Did you do any follow up work after September? Or?
No. I heard from time to time about how things were going and so on, but I didn't have any official responsibilities or concern with the specifics of what was going on.
So you were during your two visits to the country this year during that in '62. What were your impressions of the conditions in Iran?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, I was greatly impressed with the difference of all that had occurred between '42 and '62.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's amazing, and that again there was this whole question about the political structure and the problems that they faced, the question of the relationship between economic development problems and the social problems and the military problems. One point I think is important is that it has to be recognized that the military reported directly to the Shah. The military was a more closed society than in our, even in our country, for example. The budget, the cabinet, the prime minister had very little to do with military things. This was a matter essentially of the Shah, the relationship to his commander.
Mm-hmm. How was the military organized generally? Was there like an Iranian version of the Joint Chiefs staff, or, for example?
I wouldn't I wouldn't categorize it that way. They certainly, first of all, the chief of the Supreme Commander Staff was basically he was a coordinator in a sense, but the fundamental decisions were made by the Shah, dealing separately with each of the service chiefs. And that they were just, you know, these were the days before they had adequate naval force, and so everything was dealt primarily in terms of this is the role of the Army, this is the Air Force, and this is the Navy. And that there were limits to what the Chief of Staff job was. Again, the Shah was his own Secretary of Defense, if you will.
We'll talk more about that as we get back to the late 60s. After your special assignment on Iran, where were you? Where did you go next?
And then next went to SHAPE to head the plans section in the plans and operations division.
What are the functions of the functions of the plans branch?
Well, basically, to prepare strategic plans and policies.
Mm-hmm. Does this involve like working on NATO war plans, for example?
Yes.
And then from there, I guess you went.
I went to be the standing group representative with a NATO consul, and there you. Your job was to act as a forward, the representative on hand in Paris for the standing group, which consists of the U.S., British, and the French.
Now, during this period, I guess during the late 50s and early 60s, the French, I think, had a lot of disagreements with the U.S. over other questions like flexible response, military strategies. I guess the French were trying to reduce their participation in some of NATO activities during this period, the early 60s. Was there much concern about possibly De Gaulle leaving NATO, leaving the alliance structure altogether, when you were there in 62 or 63?
Well,
it happened later, obviously.
Certainly it was very clear that there were strains. My immediate boss was a French Air Force general. His superior was a deputy chief of staff who was a German army general. Now the three of us never had any serious disagreements, but it was very clear that there were these political limitations and this political climate, which made it very difficult for to carry out strategic planning, operational planning, that there were limitations, that it had a much different atmosphere than in the early days. And I think when you deal with that, you have to look primarily at De Gaulle as a person, very strong leader, the resentment that he carried over from World War II, again his views of the grandeur of France, kind of an unwillingness to accept that that it had declined somewhat. While I was still in Europe, the headquarters was moved from France to Belgium within the next year or so. So there was this general understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. After this, you were with the standing group of NATO during this period, and then you went
to be chief of staff of the 7th Army in Stuttgart.
And during, I guess during these years, I guess in 64 or 66, you were in the Stuttgart?
Yes.
Yeah. During this period, the U.S. military role in Vietnam was expanding. Did you discuss the Vietnam War issue with European military leaders? Did this ever come up in conversations with them?
It came up in conversations, yeah. But it didn't come up officially.
What kind of views did they express, the Germans or the French?
Well, of course, French had it.
Yeah.
Having been run out of Vietnam, you can imagine what their general views were, and they're concerned over the problems that we were getting into.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't try to draw too many lessons from them.
What about other European military people, like the Germans or the Belgians, or what did they?
I never
they,
got into yeah. any discussions with them.
Yeah. Okay. I guess your next assignment was Armistice Meg in Iran. After
well,
the
my next assignment, I came back to the United States at the end of '67, I think, and went to Atlanta, Georgia, I was a commander of a reserve corps for 6 months, and then I became deputy commander of Third Army, and I was there until I went back to Iran in 68.
What were the circumstances under which you were appointed chief of Armistice Meg? How did this come about?
First of all, General Eckhart. No, General Jablonski. Tour was ending. A general, and I've forgotten his name, had been designated to go to Iran, and I, for some reason, that was changed. And then the army nominated me to attend. I'm not sure. I just am not sure what led to the change in the original.
So when did you actually move to Tehran?
June of '68. Early June, maybe the end of May, as a matter of fact. But at that time.
Now this is a pretty broad question, but what were your responsibilities as chief of the U.S. military mission in Iran?
Well, I guess you can describe it in these terms. One was to administer the military assistance program. Two, to provide advice to the Iranian military and to the Shah on his armed forces. Not in terms of defense planning. That was not our job. We had to have some idea of it, but it wasn't up to us to suggest to them how they did, what their classified defense plans were. Nor were we involved in the internal security matters. Secondly, was as a member of the country team to advise, keep the ambassador posted, and of course there were many directives that came down. Either state defense messages or state messages to the ambassador, which influenced and bearing on our actions. I think you have to recognize that many of the issues and problems were more than just military. They were political as well as military. And I guess, well, the next specific job I had was being responsible for all of the military in Iran except for the attachés, and for administering the support facilities. Now, the general point, I think, which is not too well understood, is that when you are the head of a MAG or a mission, an advisor to a foreign government, your role is a little different than, say, a member of the embassy. You're there as an advisor to the government, and so this means the government has to feel comfortable with the chief of a mission, and that he's interested in their security and welfare, as in addition to his own responsibility to the U.S. government. And this is a very, very gray area sometimes.
I guess we'll probably discuss some of the implications of that as we go along, but some of the specific issues that came up. But you mentioned a minute ago that the Amishmang had no role regarding internal security. Was there still Genmish at this
yes,
point?
Yes.
But that was not under your...
No, that was held separately.
Oh, it had its own separate chief.
Yes, and this was a debatable question. For administrative reasons as well as otherwise, but it didn't really hamper our relationship.
Uh-huh. Well, who was the head of the Genmish at this time?
I just don't remember his name.
Yeah. Did they have a very big staff, or is it a small group? Or?
Very small group.
Yeah. Now, who were some of the some of the major officers in the military mission? I guess the people, there were the service chiefs. At the mission, people representing each service's interests?
Price was the... Well, there were two Air Force section chiefs who were there. I've forgotten the first one's name, but the second one was Price, Brigadier General Hal Price. Captain Harwood was the head of the Navy section most of the time I was there, all except the first few weeks. Brigadier General Metaxas headed the Army section for about a year, and then later General Patton, Ollie Patton, replaced him.
What was his first name?
Patton, Oliver.
Oliver.
I don't recall him Ollie, but Oliver Patton.
What kind of responsibilities did they have?
Well, they were responsible for the programs. For their respective services and maintain direct contact with the chiefs of the services or the commanders of the services. And then there was a small joint staff which dealt with joint matters, which I dealt with the chief SCS with.
SCS referring to?
Chief Supreme Commander's Staff, the SCS. I also dealt primarily with Tufanian on arms acquisition, particularly the U.S., solely the U.S., but well, sometimes it was more than that.
How many officers were on the Army Command staff?
Have to look it up, because they changed it while I was there. Yeah. I just have to go back and look at the numbers.
But the officers who were assigned to the Amishmang, the U.S. officers were assigned, did they work with specific Iranian units?
There were teams. For example, the ground forces had a team at Shiraz, they had a team at Esfahan, they had a team at Tabriz, they had a team Meshed. The Air Force had teams at the major air installations. The Navy had a team down at Abadan or in the Gulf there.
So you're pretty widely dispersed.
Yeah. Most of them headed by colonels. They were small teams. The service section chiefs were responsible for dealing directly with them on operational and training matters. NAG was the administrative section support command was responsible for providing their support, and this was under the joint staff.
I'm not sure this is the right word to use, but officers, how much authority, or maybe how much clout did the U.S. officers have in their dealings with the Iranian military?
First of all, they didn't have any authority.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The clout they had depended on the personalities involved on both sides.
So just change it, be different from case to case, I guess.
Yeah.
Did can you generalize about how well the Iranian and the American officers got along?
I think they got along very well. My general feeling has been all along that you have a cultural communications problem. That you have to meld, you have to take the technical expertise, if you will, of the American advisor and blend that with the cultural problems and background of the recipient country, regardless of what country we're talking about. Many times the recipient will feel that will agree, even though he doesn't really understand, or that maybe he doesn't even agree, but there is this gap which can vary. This is the reason that it's so important that people going on these assignments have a better understanding of the country, both historically, culturally, and ideally in terms of language as well.
Well, how true was that of the officers that were assigned to?
Well, generally, they had very little background before they came.
Yeah.
You know, 2 weeks orientation course here in the United States, something like that. There were a few people who spoke Farsi because they had language training, and maybe in connection with an area specialty program.
But that was a very small group of people, I suspect. But there weren't any real problems between the Americans and the Iranians. There weren't any feelings of national resentment on the part of the Iranians, or were there any problems that arose?
I think there could have been individual problems. I don't recall any issues that came up in that context that, you know, really had to become a matter of command concern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of, you mentioned the various small groups were stationed around the country at the various
cities, installations,
the cities and so forth. What kind of a responsibility do these teams have? Were they just mostly training and weapons use, or?
And support.
Uh-huh.
It varied by where, depending on the installation. Mm-hmm. They were at schools, particularly Army schools. They were at units. They were not with. They may not have been with a unit. Well, for example, they probably were stationed, in the case of the Army, at the same location as the division commander.
Mm-hmm.
And there, their job was to assist them in training, organization matters, and support matters.
Now, how closely did you work with the U.S. Embassy?
Very closely. As far as I was concerned, I had excellent relations with both Ambassador MacArthur and also Armin Meyer.
As Meyer was ambassador when you first arrived. How would you evaluate Meyer as ambassador, say, or how would you compare the two as ambassadors?
Well, in terms of the they're two different individuals.
Right.
As far as my relationships with them, there wasn't much difference in terms of my dealing with them either personally or on official matters. I'd worked with MacArthur before in Europe and here in the States, so I knew him. And I had a close relationship with him. I understood where I thought the military stopped and the political became a factor, and the importance for them to know all of the issues and any problems that we had. With respect to their relations with the Iranian people and with the government, I think they probably came out pretty much the same. Again, and this is, you read so much about it and hear so much. When you're an ambassador to a country, or when you're an IG or something, there are certain constraints that you have to recognize if you're going to be acceptable to the head of the government. And all of the critics who say, you know, that you're in too close a circle, you certainly are not going to go out and, at least outwardly, try to curry the support or somebody of the opposition. This is something many of the academicians don't understand. I dealt with the head of the army, with the head of the central bank. We discussed the problems of the relationship of the military budget to the overall national budget. Also with the head of the plant organization. I spent a lot of time on such matters which related directly to the military and were very critical to it, but which were essentially civilian responsibilities. For example, the whole communication system. The Shah once asked that we study the post-exchange system, if that isn't the right name for it. But it was a very extensive, if you will, combination post-exchange commissary system to our services. Because he used that as a means of, if you will, subsidizing or giving the military an economic source of support in terms of ensuring that the prices on this, particularly the commodities and so on, were fair, and it also acted as somewhat as a restraint on the commercial enterprises in terms of what they could charge. And I had, for example, I arranged for somebody from Sears Roebuck who was skilled in merchandising to study the thing and made recommendations to the Shah. Hmm. Hmm.
How often did you meet with the Shah?
On an average every 5 weeks, thereabouts.
You met alone?
Usually? Yes. Yeah.
Did you, you kept a record of your discussions?
I submitted a record of my discussions to him and to the United States.
Okay. These are all preserved somewhere, I guess?
I didn't keep any personal records.
Yeah. Were your discussions pretty wide-ranging, or did they stick to military subjects? Or?
Wide-ranging.
Yeah.
His views of the political military situation in, you know, particularly in the Middle East and in the world at large.
How did the Shah explain his military force requirements when you met with him during this period?
I don't guess I, it depends on what you mean by force requirements. I don't think we sat down and said, how many divisions do you need?
Yeah.
This was pretty well structured by that time. They were discussed more in terms of what are the problems that you confront, that he's confronted with in trying to achieve the forces that he's, that he had or that he set out. Mm-hmm. I made a habit of never trying to say that he couldn't do anything. I always tried to couch it in the terms that if you're going to accomplish what you hope to do, then these are the things that you have to solve.
What were some of the issues that you saw as
primary
questions had to be solved?
Primarily personnel,
yeah.
The length of time it takes to train somebody, for example, to train someone who's more highly technical questions in terms of electronics, 11 years in our Air Force. I discussed a good deal the question of the role of the military academy and what is needed to bring an officer into the current military age, or then current military age. The military academy needs to revise its program. So in many of the areas that I dealt with personally, I tried to look beyond just the immediate problems and look at some of the broader issues of the total demands of the economy and the military on the country, what priorities they needed, could they get the people. At that point in time, money was not a problem because of the hike in oil prices. So the critical factor became how fast can you go and how many people do you have and what programs do you have. And I guess my basic theme was throughout those 3+ years that you can only go so fast, and if you try to expand too fast, then you may reduce the effectiveness of your forces because you have to lead off some to create new units.
How responsible was the Shah to that line of thought?
Well, at least in terms of our discussion, he was responsive to it. How much he carried it out, you know, I really wasn't there to see in the end.
That's right.
But I did observe a tremendous change between the time I was there in 62 and the time I went back in 68.
How would you define that change or characterize it?
Well, first, of course, they were better equipped.
Yeah.
They had advanced in their school systems and their training, particularly the Air Force. With respect to... There was also a very key point in terms of particularly the air of the advisors being advisors and not suddenly be finding themselves doing something because it was easier for them to do it than to take the time to train somebody to do it. Mm-hmm. When the Congress applied some constraints on the number of people that we could have, then they went to the question of a so-called task. Technical assistance field teams, which the Iranian government paid for.
They're from the Soviet.
Okay.